Welcome, friends. This is Economic Update, a weekly program designed to present you with information and analysis about the major economic trends and developments and events in our lives. What shapes our incomes, our jobs, our debts, our futures, the economics of it all. I'm your host, Richard Wolff. I've been a professor of economics all my adult life, and I currently teach at the New School University in New York City. I also write regular economic columns for truthout.org, a remarkable independent source of news and analysis on economics and many other issues. I urge you to check them out at truthout.org. If you're interested in this program and the kinds of materials we offer, please note that we maintain two websites, both available to you at no charge 24/7, and full of all kinds of materials and elaborations of what we do relatively briefly on this program. The first one is rdwolf with two F's .com. And the second one is democracyatwork.info. Not only will you find more information and references and copies of my writings and interviews on the radio and television, but there are lectures and entire classes that I've taught that are available to you there. In addition, you can follow us through these websites on Facebook, Twitter, and Pinterest, which we ask you to do. And it'll make it easier for us to communicate, you with us and we with you. And finally, both websites provide you with a way to comment directly on this program. That is, to send us your thoughts, your questions, your criticisms. We read each and every one and use them to design our programs. And we also select a few to respond to on the air. But please bear with us. We get many more of these communications than we could possibly answer, given the fact that we do this mostly on a volunteer basis. So let's turn to look at the economic conditions, prospects, as they appear in the United States and around the world as we go from the end of May into the beginning of June 2014. Well, the end of May brought, for me at least, and I suspect for many of you as well, the sad news of the passing of Maya Angelou. This was an important writer, to say the least, in the modern history of the United States and far beyond, not only because her own life extended to Africa, North and South, as well as the United States, but because she was such a powerful writer in her poetry, in her novels, in her basic ability to translate the experiences of her remarkable life into a language and an imagery that none of us will ever forget. And for me, I thought it appropriate to bring this up because, in a way, she's a model. Her work was a model of facing honestly, almost with a ruthless honesty, social conditions that were outrageous and inhuman. In her case, the focus was on racism and sexism. As a black woman in the United States, she knew all too well, but she had that uncanny ability to help everybody else not only see it, but as she said, feel it by means of her work. Nothing would give me greater pleasure than to think I might learn from her how to do that, along with all the others she's inspired, in terms of the economic realities we face, which she also talked about, but I would love to think of what we're doing as an attempt to try to face up, as she did so beautifully, to the actuality of the conditions and to the ability of human beings to face them, to rise above them, and then to transform them into something that's more human. The first regular update I wanted to share with you has to do with the movement of students in Latin America, and in particularly in the country of Chile. The last few weeks have brought remarkable news that the three-year campaign of the students of Chile, particularly the university students, to confront the neoliberal regime there, the regime that, like in so many countries, thinks that what a forward-looking society ought to do is cut the funds it provides to education, These were students who said, no, 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 no. You're not going to solve the economic problems you caused, looking right at the power structure of Chile, the government and the major corporations, both Chilean and foreign, that dominate their economy. No, the student said, you're not going to solve the problem you created with your economic system by slashing and cutting our education. No. And for the last 3 years, the students put their bodies where their mouths were. They went on demonstrations that shook the world and that shook the government and the power structure of Chile. And it culminated a couple of weeks ago in a speech given by the president, Michelle Bachelet. And this president announced that she was going to make a major change. She was going to end the subsidies that go to for-profit schools. This comes out of the movement that thinks that a school that adds the issue of profitability to the issue of education represents an advance rather than a retreat from what the process of education is all about. She will stop subsidizing those, and she announced major moves towards the number one demand of the Chilean students, which is free, universal, public education at all levels as a basic human right. More power to these students. Amazing that they had the ability to see clearly, like Maya Angelou might have inspired them to do, and also to act politically and courageously against all the news reporters who said nothing would change, against all the politicians who announced that nothing would change. Guess what? The students persevered, and the changes are coming. That's worth everyone knowing and paying attention. The second update that I want to bring to your attention has to do with a report issued on the 21st of May by the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, one of the 12 Federal Reserve Banks across the United States. And this is a report produced by Jason Abel and Richard Deitz called Jobs That Have Been Created During the Recovery, is what the report's about. My apologies. The Federal Reserve Bank of New York covers New York State, Northern New Jersey, and Puerto Rico. That's what it researches and that's what it writes about. And here's the interesting story it tells about the quote-unquote recovery in New York, Northern New Jersey, and Puerto Rico. First, it points out that the recovery is extremely uneven. Wow, let's pursue that a moment. Uneven how? Well, it turns out New York, by their measure, has recovered, at least in terms of the number of jobs available to New Yorkers today compared with what it was before this crisis hit in 2007. But when they looked at Northern New Jersey, the story was much less positive. And when they looked at Puerto Rico, there's no improvement at all. So it turns out that when you look at New York, Northern New Jersey, and Puerto Rico, you don't have a recovery. You have barely a recovery in New York and none at all in Puerto Rico, and a very, very weak one, hardly deserving the word recovery, in Northern New Jersey. But the Federal Reserve report is important in a second way. It looks at the kinds of jobs. And here it discovers something very, very important. High-skilled, high-paid jobs have recovered. But people with middle-level jobs, middle-level incomes, they haven't recovered at all. They're in worse shape today than they were in 2007. Part of their situation doesn't appear that way because many of those people did get jobs, not enough to give us a recovery of all employed, but they got jobs, but the jobs they got are at the bottom, very low pay. So if you look at the so-called recovery, you discover, even in the words of the Federal Reserve Bank, that it's highly uneven geographically, and it's highly uneven in terms of what kind of jobs did recover and what kind didn't. When you put these two things together, a reasonable person ought to conclude there is no recovery. Or at the very least, if you want to use the word, then honestly apply it only to those few parts of the economy that have recovered, and be honest enough to say that a recovery in having a job when you didn't have one ought to be qualified if the job you got now pays you half or less what it paid in the job you had before. This kind of looking a little bit below the surface can be used elsewhere. I was struck by a report on CNBC of May 27th by Diana Olick, in which she does some research about the housing market. So let me talk to you briefly about that. Over the last year, we've heard an endless amount of public relations stuff about the recovery in the housing market. Recovery, we are told, is measured by how many apartments or homes are being built. We're being told how the prices of housing and apartments is going up, etc. Well, they looked a little bit below the numbers, and they made use of a very important bit of research done by the Redfin Group, that is a Seattle, Washington-based real estate brokerage outfit that does very good research, as Diane Olick pointed out. And here's what we discover when we look beneath the numbers, that the housing market has begun to cool off. That the press noticed. We're still better off, more houses being built than a year ago. Prices rising more relative to what they were a year ago. But when you look beneath the surface, here's what happens. The 1% of the most expensive houses in the United States, they went up over the last year spectacularly. According to Redfin, 21%. That's the increase from a year ago to now in the price of the 1% highest priced homes. What about the other 99%? How'd they do over the same period of a year ago to now? Answer, they dropped an average of 7.6%. So let's do that again. The housing market, which has been doing great, we're told, and while it's slowing a little bit, it's still well better off than a year ago. That turns out not to be true for 99% of us. It's just true for the 1% at the top. And somehow, this gets to be called a recovery in the housing market. Well, I'm reminded when I read all these things, and I point them out to you, of a famous story about Nazi Germany back in 1943 or 44. Two Germans were sitting on a bluff overlooking the Rhine River, which is a very important river in Germany. And one was saying to the other, "Isn't it fantastic that despite the war, we're doing so well? Adolf Hitler has an economy that's booming along. The traffic up and down the Rhine River shows how our factories are booming." And the other person sitting next to him says, "We're looking at the Rhine River here, Hans. I don't see anything. I don't see any barges moving. I don't see any traffic. What are you talking about?" To which Hans replies with his hauteur in high gear. Says, "You don't look at the river to learn about the economic activities. You look in the newspaper, and that's how you find out." Yes, what you find out in the newspaper and what's going on may or may not be very similar. Our next update. Yet again, a measure of recovery, but now more intelligently put, recovery for whom? Here I want to bring you information produced by Monique Morrissey for the Economic Policy Institute in Washington. And she does an interesting study. She looks at the average cost of a hotel room for a night and its relationship to the average daily pay of a housekeeper who cleans hotel rooms. All right, how much does it cost to stay in the room per day? And how much is paid to the person who makes it clean and nice and all the rest per day? Well, here's what she found. In 1982 and 83, the two amounts were roughly the same. Average room rate, about $40, might come as a surprise to some of you who haven't been paying attention to what's been going on with hotel rooms. But the average price of a hotel room overnight in the United States in 1982 or 83 was about $40. In 2012, things had changed. Even though back in 82, 83, it cost $40 to stay in a hotel room per night, and it cost $40 to pay the woman, usually, who cleaned all the hotel rooms per day. By 2012, these two numbers had grown apart. By 2012, the average overnight room rent in the United States at a hotel was $106. But what had happened to the average daily pay of the woman who cleans the hotel? That had risen to only $83. In other words, those people who stay in hotels are paying $106, but those people who clean the hotels have not kept up with our economic increases. Their wages are falling further and further behind. Try to tell them about economic recovery. The last short update before we get into our larger discussions has to do with the stunning news out of Detroit in the last days of May. The latest commission to study and come up with a proposal for what to do with the largest bankruptcy any city in the United States has ever had or faced has come up with an extraordinary proposal. Before I tell you what it is, I want you to keep something in mind. Keep in mind the boast that our economic system, our way of organizing the production and distribution of goods and services, capitalism is its name, terribly enjoys boasting of its efficiency, how efficiently it uses land, labor, tools, equipment. Keep that little story of efficiency in mind as we hear what the latest proposal out of official Detroit is. They want to spend between $500 million and $2 billion, those are their estimates, to demolish 40,000 buildings and properties in the city of Detroit. Properties that are vacant, properties that are dilapidated, houses that have been damaged, worn out, fallen in on themselves, and so on. They want to spend public money to destroy housing. This is a country, let me remind you, that has a housing problem. It has people with no place to live, and they propose to destroy 40,000 homes. When did these homes become a problem? Some of them 20 years ago, others 15 years ago, others 10 years ago, others 5 years ago, and others last year. During all that time, neither the city of Detroit, nor the state of Michigan, nor the government of the United States was able to see anything, hear anything, or do anything. So the houses dilapidated. A house that caught fire was then able to set fire to the neighboring houses because nothing had been done. And why was all this abandonment of property happening in Detroit? The answer is very simple. Detroit was a city built on the automobile. That's where Ford, General Motors, Chrysler, all of them, that's where they got their big starts. That's where they got their big growth. In 1960, Detroit had 1.8 million people. By some estimates, 2 million people because of undercounting. Today, their population is less than half of that, around 700,000. Why? Because the auto companies decided they could make more money going somewhere else, to the American South, to Canada, to Mexico, and more recently, to China and Brazil. The companies moved to make more money for themselves. They left behind an economic disaster, which now we are told, after the neglect of that disaster for 25 years, has of course only made it worse, that we need to spend billions of dollars of public money to destroy the houses that were not inhabited by the people who had no jobs when the car companies left. Is this an efficient economic system? Do you think this is an efficient way to use city land, city property? Is this an efficient way to build housing, to use housing, to maintain housing? Is it an efficient way to use public money? Stop. You know, and I know, that what we have here is an awful failure of an economic system to figure out what its problems are, to be public and open about them, to invite a public discussion of how best to solve them, and to then let democracy decide who pays for the solutions to the problems who caused. We don't do that in the United States. We allow private corporations to go where they want, when they want, how they want, leaving behind whatever destruction and broken economic disasters they see fit to leave us with. And they let it sit and rot until the rot becomes so severe that the only solution they can think of is to destroy 40,000 homes and stores and buildings. By some estimates, it'll have to be much more. The only thing to say about this is we need to learn. We need to learn that we can't solve the problems of a city caused by private enterprises by figuring out which people in Detroit or Michigan or around the country are going to be taxed more to help solve the problems of Detroit. We can't have some of us living in Detroit set against the rest of us living outside of Detroit when the people who caused the problem and haven't contributed to solving it are laughing all the way to the bank, the car companies. But of course, if we don't learn from this lesson, and if we don't learn from the kind of courage and persistence shown by the students in Chile, well, I'll have more such stories to tell you in the future. Let me turn now to the first of our large topics. These are topics, to remind you, that I pick often based on the emails you send us, on what you would like us to talk about, what issues you're interested in. And I want to thank Keith Harrington for having brought the next story to my attention and urging me with good arguments to attend to it here on the air. What I want to talk to you about is a growing international movement among students of economics, both undergraduate and graduate students. They are very unhappy with what they're being taught. They criticize the curriculum. They criticize their teachers. They feel that the economics they're being taught is extremely narrow. They're only taught one theory, they say, even though there are alternative theories about how economies work and what problems they have and what solutions work best. They're not given courses in the different theories and their different analyses and their different proposals for solution. They're only taught one, and they're not happy about it. And number two, they think the one they're taught is extraordinarily unrealistic, to boot. And here's what they mean. They say, we look around the world today, and we see a capitalist economic system that is not working for most people, that has produced a crisis on a scale of the Great Depression of the 1930s, a crisis that has lasted far longer than anyone foresaw, that has hurt more people than anyone virtually anyone predicted, that is costing a fortune in the losses of output, in the interrupted careers and lives of countless hundreds of millions of people. I mean, we're seeing an economic system in deep trouble, but we're taught an economic theory which says everything is fine, and we live in an economic system which doesn't have very serious problems, and when it encounters a few problems, it is the best self-healing mechanism the world has ever seen. We find this to be extraordinarily unrealistic. It's as if those students had said, as I did earlier today, that what is being spoken about in the media, what the pundits mostly tell us, isn't what is actually going on. So their first argument is what we're taught is too narrow, too focused on one theory, and number two, it isn't realistic. And the third thing they've had to say, very interesting, is that economics narrowness is not just about focusing on one theory, but not dealing with what is being learned about life in all the other disciplines, history, psychology, sociology, biology, and so on. That they don't like economics because it's theoretically narrow, but it's also intellectually narrow. It only focuses on its own little technical information, its own little technical models, without incorporating the rich learning being done elsewhere. Well, there was a story in the May 4th Guardian, the British newspaper, and there was also a long article on May 13th issue of the New Yorker magazine, for those of you that would like to learn more about it. But there's an even easier way. So active has this student revolt in economics been that it has engaged organizations in many countries, and they've now gotten together in something called the International Student Initiative for Pluralism in Economics. I'll say that again. The International Student Initiative for Pluralism in Economics. Initials ISIPE. If you go to ISIPE.net, you can get all the information on that website you might like about this revolt of the economics students, an international revolt. Let me say first and foremost, as a professor of economics all my life, and an economics student before that, that I am thrilled about this, that I think this is the healthiest development in this field in many, many decades, basically back until to the 1960s, when organizations like the Union for Radical Political Economics was born out of many of the same concerns. It takes courage for students to go against their teachers. That's who the authority is in the classroom. It takes an openness to different ways of thinking that is remarkable among students because it is so rare among their economics professors. It's also a sign that if change is going to come, long overdue change, to our universities, it's likely going to be the students who make it happen. Just as it's the students who have transformed the economics of education in Chile, it is students that now want to transform the very nature of teaching and of what is taught in more and more universities around the world. Maybe they, by their activity, will be a model for the faculty and the administrators that are so much slower to get going to make the changes they should have made long ago. When we return from our usual short break, I'm going to say a few words about economics education that I hope will provide a useful addition to what these courageous students in their movement have already achieved and look positioned to achieve in the future as well.
Shadows are falling, and I've been here all day. It's too hot to sleep, and time is running away. Feel like my soul has turned into steam. I've still got the scars, but the sun and me.
Welcome back. This is Economic Update. I'm your host, Richard Wolff. We're now going to enter the second half of our weekly program, Economic Update. I want to remind you, as I always do, please use and visit our websites, rdwolff.com and democracyatwork.info to find out more about the stories we're presenting today, to follow the kinds of work out of which this program develops, to communicate with us. Again, you can send us your comments, your criticisms, your questions directly through either of those websites. And finally, I want to remind you that it's through those websites that with one click, you can follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Pinterest so that we can have an even greater degree of communication going forward. Before our mid-program break, we were talking about this remarkable international movement among students of economics, both undergraduate and graduate. And I had just finished telling you about their website, isipe.net, the initials referring to the International Student Initiative for Pluralism in Economics. And I want to say a few words about the field of economics to help you, my listeners and viewers, get a feeling for what's bothering these students beyond their very eloquent statements. First, one of the things I learned as a longtime student of economics in the United States, both undergraduate and particularly graduate studies, was that economics departments were peculiar in a way that other departments were not. The way economics departments were peculiar was this. I began to realize as I sat through course after course that what I was being taught was not about how economies work. That really was a secondary issue, and in many courses, it never arose at all. Instead, what I was being taught was an elaborate theoretical argument about why capitalism, the system we live in, a system of private property and markets and all of that, was the best system human beings could possibly hope to achieve. In other words, my courses were what I would call justifications or rationalizations or celebrations of a particular system, namely the one we had. It became clear to me that economics was a way of celebrating the status quo, celebrating what exists. And my teachers and the curriculum were very uninterested in looking at critical theories, critical arguments about our system, and they were particularly uninterested in looking at alternative theories or alternative systems. True, many curriculums had a course called Comparative Economic Systems, but in 99% of our universities, these were courses that found in this title yet another way to say how what we have in the West, in the capitalist part of the world, was the best thing since sliced bread, and the alternatives were really very poor second and third choices that no reasonable person would want to spend any amount of time learning about. So bad was the focus of economics on justifying the system that even businesses across the United States in particular, and I know the history of economics teaching in the United States better than I know the history in other countries, but so irritated were the business community that they were getting these students who could justify capitalism to beat the band. But they didn't know how the system worked that they were so busy celebrating. They didn't understand the nitty-gritty of business at all. And so the business community said, look, we really like it that you're spending all this time basically preaching to the student body how they should love and celebrate capitalism, the status quo, what exists. We're glad you're doing that. But you know, you're next to useless for teaching our young people how the economy actually works so that they can go out there and be productive workers in a business, or start a business, or build a business. This is what we need. And so in America, the solution to this criticism of the business community was to create a parallel curriculum. Side by side, in most American universities, side by side with the economics department, is another department that teaches economics, only we don't call it that. To save face all around, we call that second program business school. You go there to learn how businesses actually work, how taxation affects a business, how a payroll program affects a business, how businesses have to do advertising, marketing, accounting, and all the other real-world issues which we've consigned to the business school. If you understand that, you'll see why students might be very irritated to be learning theories that are all about celebrating the status quo at a time when the economy they live in doesn't look anything like the economy they're being taught to celebrate. It's because they have no contact with a curriculum that tries to deal with the actualities. That's done somewhere else in the business school. And there they don't much interested in criticism either, which means a student who would like to be exposed to the critique of something that strikes him or her as not working real well isn't going to find that, and that's making students upset, angry, and critical. Second, I discovered as a student and then as a teacher that it takes time to learn a theory. There's a reason why graduate school for most economics professors in the United States is something that they spend 3, 4, 5, 6 or more years doing. They take lots of courses, 2 to 3 years worth of them usually, and then they spend another several years becoming specialized in some literature that will allow them to write a doctoral dissertation. In other words, they spend years learning a theory and then years learning how to apply and use it to write a piece of analysis. If you're honest and open that there are more than one theory of economics and that your students should be proficient, at least on some basic level, in all of them in order to be able to enter the debate about which of them to be used in forming policy, in changing for the better our economic system, then you're going to have a curriculum that gives significant attention to these alternative theories. Because to learn a theory, as we know from the one we celebrate in the United States, takes time, takes faculty, takes multiple people to teach multiple courses. That would mean our faculties have to include people who are proficient. Well, let's see, proficient in what? Well, besides the theory that we celebrate capitalism with, a theory called neoclassical economics for historical reasons, there are two big other theories. One is called Keynesian economics. It comes out of the Great Depression when a very acute British economist, John Maynard Keynes, made a critique. And the critique said capitalism left to itself produces great downturns, something which might strike you as interesting considering that we're living in one. And he came across with an idea that said the government needs to intervene to minimize the damage caused by these crises, to reduce their severity, to make them less frequent. In other words, capitalism doesn't work well unless and until it has massive ongoing government intervention. Keynesian economics isn't taught in most American universities at all, or it's taught in a way that dismisses it, a little bit like those courses in comparative systems I talked about that dismiss rather than analyze these alternatives. So it makes perfect sense that graduate students who become aware of the Keynesian criticism, or even more, the Marxian alternative, because Marx said, with or without the government, more or less involved, capitalism itself has such profound problems that the government can't solve them, and that the solution to capitalism's deepening problems is to go to another system called socialism, communism, or something else. Of course, if you want students to be able to even think like that, to explore what those possibilities might be, to develop whatever insights that theory enables, well, then you've got to have those people in the university. And what the students are saying is, they're not here. We don't have Keynesian faculties, and we sure don't have Marxian faculties. We don't have anyone to teach it. And so what you're doing is the equivalent of the following. Imagine that university courses taught religion, And when you took a course in religion, what you learned about was the particular details of one brand of Lutheranism. Now, surely Lutheranism is part of religion, should be taught. But you wouldn't want to call religion something as narrow as just Lutheranism. You'd want the religion program to teach about Catholicism, about Presbyterianism, about Buddhism, about Islam. In other words, you want to teach the course in an honest way that confronts the reality of alternative, contesting, different religions. The students want that. And there is no excuse for not providing it. But in the United States, you can't provide it the way universities are organized. They're very small-minded, self-contained institutions that teach one thing and then give the jobs they have to the students who've learned that one thing, who then can continue to teach that one thing as if it were the only way to think about economic issues and economic problems. The wonder isn't that students are protesting. The real wonder is, why haven't more students joined? Why hasn't this happened before? But that's not a criticism. What these students are doing is extraordinarily productive and profound, and they, like their brothers and sisters in Chile, deserve our support and our applause. The next topic I want to talk about is advertising. And I want, again, as I did with the earlier topic of Detroit, to ask you to keep in mind the boast that our economic system is all about efficiency, all about using land, labor, and capital, tools and equipment and people in the most efficient way possible to produce the goods and services that we as a community most want to have, etc., etc., etc. Keep that in mind as we analyze the advertising industry. First, let's be sure we all understand advertising is an industry in this country that employs huge numbers of people and accounts for an enormous amount of business. Here are the statistics. For 2010, the numbers, of course, would be larger if we updated them to 2014. But in 2010, spending on advertising in the United States was $143 billion, that's with a B. And in the world as a whole, $467 billion. In other words, in 2010, global spending on advertising was $500 billion. It is huge. And yet the industry is young. It basically begins, modern advertising does, in the 1920s, here in the United States. And it begins, and there's an enormous historical irony here, with the tobacco industry. The big explosion of advertising was to promote cigarettes. And for the next 70 years, advertising was a big part of the budget of the cigarette companies. They spent billions of dollars, employed tens of thousands of people to develop and to disseminate in this society, on the billboard, on the back of the magazine, on the television, wherever you turn to see advertising, messages urging you to buy something, because that's all advertising is. You saw advertising for cigarettes. For decades after the cigarette companies knew that smoking cigarettes, whatever else it did for you, also gave you cancer, they continued to advertise this product. And I want to talk to you about that because of its economic significance and because of what it tells us about efficiency. Was it efficient for the cigarette companies to be allowed to flood the television and the radio and the newspaper and the billboards with ads of people happily enjoying cigarettes? Was that efficient? Was that the best we could do with all of the equipment, all of the artistic talent that's involved in the advertising business? Was that the best we could do with all those people and all those talents and all those resources, was to convince folks to smoke cigarettes? While you're thinking about that, let's analyze advertising. It's an industry that figures out ways to get you to part with your money. Advertising says, buy this. No, buy that. Advertising is the way they wrap the soap, so that you think you're not only getting something that'll make your body clean, but it'll be something that makes you smell wonderful and that makes people interested in you romantically, etc., etc. Advertising is that picture on the billboard of the happy people at the beach drinking beer. Advertising is the story they tell you, that this car has all of this power and that you will be powerful because you're driving it. You know, we all know what advertising is, because it overwhelms us every day 1,000 times. But when you actually go to buy something, let's look at this. If you're smart, if you're thoughtful, like most folks are, you will go and say to a friend, a neighbor, a relative, I'm thinking of buying a car, a toaster, a software program, whatever it is, and tell me what's been your experience. And you expect your friends and relatives to be honest, to say to you, well, I ended up buying brand X. It was strong in these ways and weak in these other ways. But when I compared it to the strengths and weaknesses of the alternatives, this is the thing I did. And I had a couple of years' experience, and I learned that it probably would be better to go from brand X to brand Y, and so I changed. This is useful advice. You've gotten useful advice from a thoughtful person who talks to you about the strengths and weaknesses, and thereby provides you with good advice. In contrast, advertising is bad advice. Why is it bad? Because you know that the person delivering it to you is not interested in providing you with information on strengths and weaknesses. The name of the game in advertising is the strengths, please. The advertiser tells you everything about a product's strength. You hope it isn't all invention, but you must know, unless you really were born yesterday, that an advertiser is never paid by the producer of anything to tell you about problems it has, or weaknesses it suffers from, or failures it has accounted for. No. An advertiser, you know, is a source of lopsided, one-sided, unbalanced information. If you knew that a friend or relative of yours would only tell you one side of the story, either all the good things about something or even only all the bad things, you would after a while not rely on their advice real much, would you? No, I didn't think so. You'd know it was unreliable. Well, advertisers are unreliable. They are an unbalanced, a poor source. And by the way, if you're interested in getting information about goods and services that is balanced, there are ways of doing that. The Consumers Union was developed in the United States decades ago to produce a magazine, and they now have a website where they will tell you about the strengths and weaknesses of alternative brands and so forth, and so you can make a rational decision. Rational because you're not listening to advertisers who are, as I've pointed out, very poor sources. Well, what do the advertisers say to defend themselves from this sort of criticism? Well, one of the things I found charming was the following. Pepsi-Cola, for example, and I'm picking them up. I didn't have a conversation with them, so I'm just using them as an example. Pepsi-Cola would say, for example, we have to advertise because if we don't, then everybody just sees Coca-Cola, and they'll just think about Coca-Cola, and they won't think about Pepsi-Cola, and so we have to advertise because our competitors do. Now, let's be economists for a minute and analyze that. We are going to have billions spent on advertising, not because it provides any information that anybody needs or wants, not because it clarifies anything. The only reason we're getting that money spent on all those people using all of their brain power and all of those resources to give us yet another reason to buy Pepsi, that the reason we're doing that is because they have to, since Coca-Cola does it. So we have to spend billions on advertising. Why? Because there are already billions being spent on advertising. This is not an efficient use of resources. This is lunacy. This is craziness. This is an economic system that is not only not efficient, but is veering off the tracks into the most grotesque inefficiency and waste of resources one could imagine. Let me conclude by giving you what is arguably the most remarkable craziness about the economics of advertising. Ever ask yourself the question, who pays for the advertising? Who pays all the money to have that billboard that you pass by in your automobile advertise this or that? Who pays for the glitzy ad at the back of the magazine? Who pays for the television show that you watch, interrupted periodically by an advertisement for who's ever funding the television or radio show? Who pays? Well, you know the answer on one level. The company that makes the product pays the advertiser. The company that makes the soda pop pays the advertiser who puts those billboards everywhere. The company that makes the cigarette pays the advertiser, and so on. But now let's review the economics here. Where do you think the company that pays the advertiser gets the money with which to pay the advertiser? The answer, dear fellow citizen, is you and me. We pay. We pay more for the products we buy because the product we buy requires advertisement, or at least they think they do. Let me give you a couple of examples that, if you don't know about this, may shock you. Many over-the-counter medicines, you know, cough syrups, aspirin or aspirin-type products, anti-allergy medicines, things like that, many of them cost pennies per pill, per capsule. Pennies, 5 cents, and to make. Oh, sure, you add a little bit because they had to have laboratories and researchers to come up with these compounds. And maybe that's another few pennies. But then there's an enormous extra expense that works out to be 20, 30, 40, 50 cents, much more than it costs to make the pill, much more than it costs to do the research leading to the pill. You know what that extra cost is? Advertising it. Making sure you see at every turn in your life, this is the way to cure your headache. This is the way to cure your allergies, to stop sneezing. So guess what? The reason you have to pay 50 cents or a dollar for a pill that costs 2 cents to make is because the price of the medicine includes the cost to the producer of paying for the advertising. Now, let me point out to you what that means. You, when you buy over-the-counter medicine, are paying the money required to convince you to buy that medicine. You're paying for the advertisement. You are wasting your money to produce what we have shown is bad and unreliable advice. Wow. Same thing with soda pop. Soda pop, and I hate to break this to you if I'm the first one, soda pop is water that contains color and sugar and not much else. Okay? You want to drink that? That's your business. But when you go and produce water with some color and sugar in it, that doesn't cost anything. That is unbelievably cheap. Water is cheap, sugar is cheap, and color is cheap. And a few other ingredients. They're cheap too. What does it cost to have a bottle of soda? 5 cents. 10 tops. But you know you can't pay that. What are you paying for? A lot of laboratory work to invent the thing? No. The syrups behind these pop drinks are 100 years old. You know what you're paying for? The ads. You're paying the cost of all the billboards and all the TV spots and all the advertising to get you to drink soda pop A versus soda pop B. That's the way our system works. Is that efficient? Well, I hope you've stopped laughing. It has nothing to do with efficiency. It has to do with the peculiarity of our economic system that allows private companies to quote-unquote compete with one another, tells us all the time how wonderful that competition is, without ever admitting in an open and honest way that one of the consequences of competition among private enterprises is an unspeakably wasteful loss of people's creativity and of countless resources to do something that clogs the airwaves with information and advice that are fundamentally unbalanced and unreliable. That's a cost of competition. That's a cost of capitalism. Imagine if the people, those creative artists and publicists and people who do all the work of advertising, imagine if we asked the American people or the British people or the European people or the Asian people or the African people or anyone, would you rather have endless advertisements that you mostly can't rely on and don't believe anyway? Or would you like to see all those resources used to beautify our cities and towns, to educate or better educate our children, to provide meaningful programs for the elderly in our community? You really think a system, a society, can't do better than the colossal waste of advertising? I think you could share with me the notion, yes, we can do better than advertising in an economic system, and we can do better with an economic system that doesn't cut back on the waste of advertising, but proliferates and enlarges it, finds ways to put advertising everywhere, even in places we had no idea could be polluted by yet more unbalanced and unreliable advice. Thank you very much for your attention. That's the end of our program for this week. This is Richard Wolff on Economic Update. Looking forward to connecting with you again next week. Change.